On this episode of Marketing Mavericks, we talk about Twitter adding a buy button, social commerce, speculating on Apple's big announcement, and Malaysian Airlines marketing fail. Coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Marketing Mavericks is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. It's simple, honest, and easy to use. For 10% off your first purchase, go to Hover.com and enter the code MM9. And by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards in one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/MM. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MM. And by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting, healthy snacks right to your door. Forget the vending machine and start snacking smarter and healthy. Delicious treats like dark cocoa almonds. To get your free NatureBox sampler, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's free NatureBox snacks at naturebox.com/twit. This is Marketing Mavericks, episode 22, recorded Monday, September the 8th, 2014. Shopping while you tweet. Welcome to Marketing Mavericks, where we talk about everything at the intersection of marketing and technology, advertising, wearable tech, all kinds of stuff. And today is no exception. We're going to do a deep dive on wearables and Twitter and what's happening with the Apple announcement and much more. Our guests today are Esteban Contreras, who is the Director of Strategy at Sprinklr. Welcome back, Esteban.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Bob Norp, who's the host of The Beancast, is a consultant in New York and recently an adjunct professor at New York State University, right?
Absolutely. I pity the young people of this country.
I pity the fool. I'm like, wow, congratulations, Bob. That's a big deal.
It really is. It's very, very cool to finally, you know, be bringing some education into this world of marketing, you know, marketing and social media and everything else that deals with it. Well, I'm teaching a course on integrated marketing at NYU. It was a class that I guest lectured in once in a while, and they just kind of gave me the nod and said, take over the class. So here I am.
And you had how long to prepare?
I had 4 days. I had to put together an entire syllabus for the entire semester in 4 days and then teach a class. But it went well. The first class was really excellent, and I got great feedback from the students. So I'm really excited about this. It's something I've wanted to do. I mean, everything I do is about marketing education. I work with startups to help them figure out how to market smarter. I do the Beancast, which is all about trying to educate the marketing community about better ways to do things. So, I mean, it kind of fits into the whole theme about what the Beancast brand is about.
I think you have a great show, and I'm a big fan of yours, of course. So too bad I can't just stream into your online class. That'd be kind of cool.
that would be something. But I doubt NYU would be all that excited about streaming my class unless you were paying for it.
I know. Well, you know, I totally get it. And Esteban, you've been at Sprinklr now for 2 years. Congratulations on your anniversary.
Thank you.
And tell a little bit about what Sprinklr does.
Yeah, so Sprinklr is an enterprise social media management platform, and we work with the world's best brands. So if you are working at a large brand and you want to manage social media across sometimes hundreds, thousands of people are all over the world, and you want to be publishing, engaging, reporting, doing listening, command centers, managing paid media, Sprinklr does it all. And we focus on the biggest brands on earth, so the Nikes and Microsofts and Samsungs of the world.
The biggest brands on earth. So that's a lot. That's pretty big brands. Just saying. So glad to have you both back. There's a lot happening in the news this week with wearables and all the big announcements and the security leaks with potentially, you know, as marketers, how do we market a product that we can't necessarily say is secure? And then there's the big announcement tomorrow with Apple. And I know, Bob, you and I were talking about this before the show. That's got a lot of us interested. And
We covered a big segment on it on my show. We talked about the fact that, you know, it's not just that they're coming out with another phone, and it's not just that they're coming out with an iWatch. That's the big tech stories. But the big marketing story in this is the mobile payment system. I mean, if it's true, if the rumor's true, and they add an NFC chip in, and they've done these great payment deals with all the major processing companies, this could be revolutionary. I mean, it takes away the need to carry a wallet, and it puts in your hands something that you can pay for anything, anywhere. I mean, all the mobile payment processing companies, Visa, Discover, Amex, all of them have been trying to force their retail partners to put in NFC readers over the past couple of years. They've said that there's a mandate to do it because they're even holding over the fact that they're not going to honor fraud protection for retailers that are using magnetic strips, that they're only going to honor it if you have an NFC chip. So the plays have already been put in motion. And now with Apple having that, you know, that Apple brand behind it and having all these great deals, it could actually usher in true mobile payments. And I think that's the most exciting thing.
So, okay, but as a consumer, even though Apple said, hey, this isn't our issue, the security breach wasn't really a security breach, the average consumer, I think, probably feels like it was. Is this going to be a problem? Or as marketers, how are they going to be able to reach people that are in, you know, I'm already nervous about sometimes using my, I don't know, debit or credit card online. And, you know, we hear, you know, the Target, Home Depot. I mean, there's been all kinds of breaches in security. So how can we trust a payment system that has been in the news? I mean, should we be leery of this?
Exactly the same question I asked. Esteban, what do you think? I mean, the Saul cult was saying over and over again, people will always choose the easiest solution. They will always choose the easiest solution. And they're not really concerned about security as much as they say they are. In the end, if it's easy and it works and they're safe, they haven't had any bad experiences, they're going to choose it. I mean, what's your thoughts on it, Esteban?
Yeah, I think that privacy and security is a bigger deal than most people realize. But that being said, they really, truly do not care as much as they would say on a survey. So if you're answering a survey and somebody asks you, what do you think about your privacy, your security? You're always going to say, absolutely, it's the most important thing, my privacy, my security. But once you get into the real world and you start seeing new ways of dealing with, you know, seamlessly paying for things or seamlessly, you know, boarding a flight, those things start to not be as important because most people simply do not understand how these systems work. And we have seen a lot of people that were skeptical about smartphones for years, and now they're jumping from, you know, a landline to the latest Galaxy S or the latest iPhone. And I think that Apple has been missing from this space of payments in the sense of being able to go to a location and use your phone to pay. And if this is the case, then now, you know, Android and iOS are both going to be good options for people to do this. And it may change things.
But what about the trust issue? I mean, it's just like, what about Tanya's question about trust? I mean, is this something that is Apple's trust strong enough? Have they been cavalier about their security? I mean, everybody on my show was saying, absolutely not. It's that they take security very, very seriously, and really it falls on the consumer in the end to just have good password protection. But I'm not exactly entirely convinced that it's not somewhat Apple's problem that they're not putting in place the checks and balances and the alert systems and everything else necessary to make sure that if you have suspicious activity on your account, you're going to be alerted about it. You're going to know about it.
So, yeah, Esteban, what do you think?
I think that Apple is at a bit of a crossroads now. So, you know, if you go back in history, since the beginning of the 2000s, we've seen the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad. The question is, what's next? And, you know, both payments and other parts of that infrastructure are things that are being baked in, but they're not seen as the next iPad. So the wearable devices may be what people may be excited about, but ultimately it's that infrastructure that's going to allow us to, at least the Apple users, to use this technology. And I think that trust is at a bit of a crossroads, that Apple has to convince everybody that it's still the Apple that it always was, and that it's still the cool, exciting, trendy Apple that it needs to be for people to continue buying Apple devices. But as long as they have those Apple devices, they will use whatever Apple gives them, in my opinion. That seems to be the trend, unless something better comes along. You know, iTunes was replaced by Spotify after years of it not being a very good software. But now it's Spotify and Pandora and all these other technologies have sort of taken over what iTunes had for quite a bit of time. So, you know, the big question is, can there be one single solution for payments with your devices that would go across platforms and across locations? And I could go easily to Barcelona, Spain and pay with my phone, and whatever phone helps me do that.
Here's the thing. Here's my question, though. I mean, and go ahead, Bob. I just totally cut you off there.
No, that's okay. No, my question is, when it comes down to it, mobile payment is not about whether or not the device manufacturer will give you good service. It's more about whether or not all the credit card companies, the processors, are going to give you good service. You're not going to get on the phone and talk to Apple when you have an erroneous charge on your credit card. You're going to get on the phone and talk to Amex. So in a lot of ways, I think Apple's pretty bulletproof here. I mean, they have a situation where they've done deals with the payment processors. All they are is a middleman, a technology that's facilitating transactions. It's probably the smartest play they could have made. And it's actually kind of surprising because it puts them in a position of just being, just offering a feature that they don't really control, because this feature is going to still be controlled by the credit card companies and the experience is still going to be very much a credit card transaction.
Well, that was my question is, how they responded to this was kind of, you know, hey, it's not our fault and we're really not to blame. But that goes back to customer service. So you're suggesting that the customer service is going to fall on the credit cards, the banks, and not on Apple itself. I mean, do they need to have some sort of customer service platform before they start doing this? Or are they okay like they are? Esteban?
Yeah, I think Apple's definitely making changes in terms of the touch points in which it communicates with people. So Apple has been doing more in social media, for example. But I totally agree with Bob that in the end, this is an integration play and it's a platform play. If Apple is able to get deals with all these big companies and it does basically what it has done in other industries like media and music and entertainment, then it can be very interesting. But in the end, when you have an issue with your transaction, it's going to have to be the bank, the credit card company, or some other form of transaction. You know, whether in the future we'll see more Stripe in real world, I don't know. But today, those are the big banking and financial transaction companies.
It's funny, you know, this is all rumor right now. We're still speculating. We have no idea what exactly Apple's going to announce when this payment system. But, you know, if it is true that they've done a deal with all the payment processors, they're already putting themselves in a much better position than Google Wallet ever had when they launched. And there's the inevitable comparison to Google Wallet and this new Apple system already in the press about what they're doing, how can it be different, how can it succeed where Google Wallet failed miserably. And really, it's because they went upstream. They did the deal with the processors. Google Wallet launched with a deal with Citibank. You needed to get a Citibank credit card. If you didn't have a Citibank credit card, you weren't even part of this opportunity. And people don't want to get more credit cards. They want to use the credit cards that they already have. And that's what the Apple system supposedly, or at least rumored, is going to be offering to people.
So, well, that was my question was going to be for you, Bob, was what do you think we're going to see tomorrow? I mean, what do you think is going to be the eye opener, or maybe is there anything unexpected, or do we already have it predicted pretty much?
You know, the thing that everybody's going to talk about tomorrow is if it actually happens is this iWatch. I mean, because the iWatch is supposed to be a flexible screen. It's going to be all cool. Yeah, people will all talk about the iPhone 6 and about the cool design of it, et cetera, and maybe the fact that it has two different screens. You're going to have a lot of conversation focused on that. But the real story is, I think, more on the mobile payment processing and also on signal tracking. You know, the iBeacon stuff that's going on right now, the mobile signal tracking, I mean, that's of intense interest. I've got a client who's out at CTIA this week for Super Mobility Week. Mexi is going to be out there, and they're basically doing all the mobile signal tracking for CTIA during the event. And, you know, already, the founder of this, Glenn Tenley, he's already been booked on a comment panel that CNBC is going to be doing directly following this event, directly following the Apple event. You know, this is how important that is to the industry as a whole. From the marketing perspective, those announcements are going to carry a lot more weight. What's going on with iBeacon? What's going on with signal tracking? What's going on with mobile payments?
Are you going to wear that watch? Will you wear the...
Hell to the no, man. I am a Windows Phone user, my friend.
I can't help it. I don't know. I kind of am like the only one that kind of likes it. It's a little obnoxious, I guess, but... There's a handful of us, I think, that actually like it. It's not sexy.
The iWatch is, if it comes out, it's going to be really cool, but it's only going to be really cool if you're in a completely Apple ecosystem. It means nothing if you have Android phones. It means nothing if you're using PCs. I mean, this is a device that's part of the Apple ecosystem. And unless you're a complete Apple fanboy, there's no reason to get it. If you do get it, it's just because it looks cool and it's a watch.
But does it really look cool? Because it's not really fashionable. And this is Fashion Week, right? That's happening in New York and Esteban. I mean, is it really important? I mean, you're kind of a fashionable guy, right? So how important is fashion? In fact, we were going to have Ralph Lauren on tonight and we couldn't actually make that connection work, but they're into the wearables, right? So
you're going to have the Ralph Lauren on?
Not the Ralph Lauren, but they're out of marketing and they're in this space of wearable and tech. I mean, are we getting there or are we still pretty far away? Because that watch isn't that fashionable, really.
Well, we're at the beginning stages. When the Pebble first came out, you know, it was really a geeky device. And most of the wearables out there today are meant to be utilitarian. They're meant to be prototypes or experiments or early adopter type devices. So I have a Galaxy Gear. It's something that I use from time to time. I don't wear it every single day. And so I think that the smartphone is the closest thing that we have to a wearable simply because we take it with us everywhere we go. Anything, you know, related to glasses or watches that aren't really something that we use every single day and that is fashionable enough for us to wear for a year or two, it is basically something, is more of something that we're playing with. It's almost like a toy, right? We're experimenting with this stuff and some people hate it, some people love it. The Galaxy Gear S, I think, is a huge example of how Samsung has been able to get into a space before Apple. And so the reason why I'm excited about tomorrow, even though I'm an Android user and a Samsung fan, is that when Apple gets into a market, new things happen. And so this is Apple's one and only chance. If it is tomorrow, it's their only chance to introduce something new to the world, which is what Apple does.
They do.
In this case, Samsung has been doing it for a little bit of time now. They've had three different versions already, multiple versions within each release. But the big question to me is what happens to wearables in the next 10 years? And I think ultimately it's textiles, it's clothing. It's the only thing that I wear every single day is my clothes. And so if my clothes can be connected...
I want that suit from Continuum on the Sci-Fi Channel, you know? like cool suit that like does everything because it's like completely a wearable tech device. I want that. That's what I want. I don't want a watch. I don't want glasses. I forget where I heard it. Someone actually posited that the best wearable tech that you could come out with right now would be a hat.
Yeah, I disagree with that because I don't wear hats. So, but I don't know. There's actually a wearable beanie that I think we're getting for before you buy or something. I don't see anybody wearing that. Maybe skiers.
There's already a few examples that are out there. So Ohm Signal, for example, and they're the ones powering Ralph Lauren's connected or smart shirt. And Ohm Signal is able to measure all kinds of things on shirts. And when they first came out, it was this, you know, this prototype phase of trying to convince the world that there's a need for this. But then Ralph Lauren comes along and takes that on, you know, it makes it interesting. Now it's a Ralph Lauren shirt that that athletes maybe are going to be the first ones to use it and certain people in certain cultural spheres. But ultimately, Ralph Lauren's vision must be to get everyone to use this. And so there are companies like Studio XO that are doing a lot of things to play with what does fashion and technology look like beyond these devices that are complementary. And I think ultimately the ones that are going to do interesting things are the Nikes, the Adidas, the Lululemons of the world, the Patagonias. These are the guys that will have the potential to make our clothing do things that may be good for health and ideally good for fashion, right? Make things fit better, make things change the type of material or the type of way that you wear it based on the location or the temperature that you're in. There's a lot of potential sci-fi crazy ideas.
Do you really believe that a Nike or Adidas or Under Armour or any of these companies would be the best place for that to actually spring from? Because, they've already gotten into the wearable tech market and they've already exited and they've taken more of a background type approach. We're going to do systems for the technology companies to build products that then we can implement into our running or our athletic infrastructure, you know, the clothing market that we've created. I can't see these companies doing it well or investing really, really well in it, in at least for the foreseeable future. It's got to come from the tech industry, and the tech industry has to have some more fashion sense. The tech industry has to be creating stuff that's more stylish, so that it will attract the fashion industry.
But Bob, we're a bunch of geeks. Are we really the most fashionable of all of society? Yeah, probably not.
No, we're not. But then again, it's just like, look at computer animation. I mean, computer animation was developed by people who were very techy and really had no idea what made good animation. So they brought in animators from Disney, people who knew about animation, who didn't understand the technology, but could use the tools. And it was the job of the tech people to make it more accessible to the designers who understood how to create, you know, digital animation. And I think the same is true with any kind of fashion tech that's going to happen. I mean, the tech industry needs to start hiring designers and thought leaders from the fashion industry to come help them bridge that gap and bring these two markets together.
Well, and Apple has actually tried to do that. They've actually hired a lot of people from the fashion industry. And I think I'm interested to see where this goes. I think we're still at the infancy of this. And I actually really do like fashion. So I'm excited to see if anybody that follows me on Pinterest knows that I'm kind of into the space a little bit. I'm interested. I think, though, I'm not sure that watch is really fashionable. And you know, Esteban, you talked about
looks like. We still don't know what it looks like, though. You know, you can't say that it doesn't look fashionable because we don't always see is these drawings that people have made up. And it could be really super cool. We have no idea.
Well, we'll know tomorrow, that's for sure. I want to talk about social commerce, too. I want to talk about this idea of trust and Twitter and making payments through Twitter and so much more. But before we do that, I want to thank a sponsor of Marketing Maverick, which is Hover.com. So here's the deal. When you have a great idea, you want to secure a domain name for it, right? Well, you want something catchy, memorable to represent your online identity. Hover gives you exactly what you need to get the job done. You can choose whatever you'd like, .club, .ninja, .guru, just about anything. People love Hover. Geeks, developers, designers, programmers love Hover.com. And why? Because Hover has the best tools and support. But you don't have to be an expert to get a domain, and the service is simple enough that anybody can use it. Hover takes all the hassle and friction out of registering a domain. It gives easy-to-use, powerful tools to manage your domain so that I really do mean anybody can use it. You can get perfect domain names, start building your web presence right away. Here's how. All you have to do is search for a few keywords, and Hover will show you the best available options and suggestions. Hover's clean. It's a simple website. And in less than 5 minutes, you can find the domain name that you want and get it up and running. Hover also offers valet transfer service to make your process completely painless. For free, Hover will take care of the entire process for you and let you know when your domains are settled in your Hover account. They'll transfer all your DNS settings, so no matter how many domain names you have, it's at no additional cost. Hover is honest. They don't believe in heavy-handed upselling. They include everything that you need with your domain, no more, no less. They also include custom email. You'll get the smart control panel so that you can do what you want with your domain. Plus, Whois privacy is included for free on every domain that supports it. If you ever need it, Hover has the best customer support around. It's known for its no wait, no hold, no transfer phone service. When you call, a real person is ready to help. Hover now offers volume discounts. They'll give you a discount on your domain renewal starting at just 10 domains and then going up from there. The idea is the more domains that you have in your account, the less you have to pay to renew them. So visit Hover today to register your domain name and for 10% off your first purchase. So go to hover.com and use the promo code MM9. We thank Hover for their support of Marketing Mavericks. It's a great, great tool. I don't know how many domain names you guys have, but every time I find something that I want, I get it as a domain and I just kind of put it in the bank. How many domains? I mean, come on, be honest, guys. Do you buy domains?
I don't buy a whole lot of them, but I am very proud of brandedsex.com. I'm going to do something with brandedsex.com eventually.
Awkward. Well, you know, you can save. If you have the more you have, the more you get to save. So there you have it. Branded Sex, really?
It struck me as it was available and it sounded great. And I'm just like, there's something about it. I don't know. It's just like, it doesn't have to be porn, but it could be porn. We could do porn and we could sell like product placements on people's buttocks and then it would be great. But I'm thinking that's like way too much trouble. So I'll try to come up with a better idea.
This show went an entirely different direction than I thought it might. Awkward.
There's nothing awkward about sex, my friend.
Right. Oh, here we go. I know somebody that has headboard.com. It gets a lot of offers for that.
headboard.com, which redirects to brandedsex.com.
Redirect. Okay.
So, which is in construction, thanks to Bob.
Under construction, error code. So social commerce. Has it evolved? Are we really ready to actually make payments through Twitter? What do you think about that, Esteban?
Okay, I'm sorry, Esteban. I got to jump in on this one.
Okay.
I'm not going to talk really, really long, but it's interesting that a friend of mine online, Ryan Swindell, he pointed out today, he said, you know, Twitter stopped talking about themselves as being a social network over a year ago, and Facebook has quietly stopped calling themselves a social network over the last few months. They started calling themselves a media company, and Twitter's calling themselves a news company, a news feed company. It's interesting how social networking has gone away and is being replaced by, you know, the things that are making commerce happen. It's very interesting. What would you say to that, Esteban? I mean, it's just like, is that a valid point? And is that something that we start addressing?
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely, this is a bit of a side note, but you're challenging that it shouldn't be called social commerce, basically. And I have issues with people that try to get into the technicalities of whether something is social commerce or social advertising, simply because when we say social commerce, what we're trying to say is that it happens on a social network. And the reasons why a company will call themselves something versus another sometimes has to do with all kinds of reasons, right? So Google may want to be not a search company and have a monopoly over search. They'd rather be an advertising company because in the advertising space, Google is tiny. And so nobody's going to come after Google for being too big to fail or anything like that. So it makes sense for Twitter to say, hey, we're a media company because we do media. It makes sense for Facebook to see itself as something else. There's many reasons why brands refer to themselves as something. But ultimately, Facebook and Twitter are social networks. That is what they are. And you know, in terms of commerce...
I was just going to say, Esteban, I think that the answer is much, much simpler. It's the fact that when you call yourself a social network, that's about users, and users use the social network to talk to each other. And when you call a search engine a search engine, that's what users do with this. They use it to search with. And by rebranding themselves as media companies or newsfeed companies or advertising companies, they essentially stake a territory that actually can make the money. And that's the most important thing that's going on. I mean, when Facebook calls themselves a media company, it's about page views. We can drive page views to your company if you go and post interesting media on our site, which drives more page views for us, which makes us be able to sell more advertising revenue. And I think that's what's really going on. Same with Twitter. I mean, by saying that they're a news feed company, it says, come to us for your news. Your latest breaking headlines are going to be on Twitter. This is the place to get it.
But that's where it already is. That's kind of a given. I mean, they're already a news feed. I mean, that's where we go, a lot of us,
right,
to get news and information, but we don't go there to buy products. And in fact, every time that that Twitter makes a change, and I get that they have to make money, this creates a disruption, right? And how we feel like we're getting the news. We feel like we're being forced into things that maybe aren't news, or as we saw this with Facebook, when Facebook, we thought Facebook was a media outlet, right?
You got to stop thinking of yourself as a user, and you got to start thinking about it from a standpoint of the business side of the thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. When you bring advertising into the mix, when you bring marketing into the mix, you're going to piss off a lot of users along the way. That's just a given. But the fact is, they need to make money, and they also have to position themselves in a way that's acceptable to the people who will give them money. So that's what's really going on when, you know, you're bringing up, you know, the fact that Twitter's doing advertising, everybody's putting buy now buttons in place. Everybody's trying to drive revenue. It's because we need to try to start going to the people who will make us money and telling them a story that shows them that this is a legitimate stream for income. If it's just about, we got all these people interacting, I got 1 billion people on Facebook and they're all networking constantly, where they're posting so many pictures and posts, and you get so much engagement. I mean, it's like Peter Shankman always says, he's talked to a lot of CEOs. Not one of them has ever come to him and said, Peter, my engagement numbers are up this past week. My engagement numbers are up. So, no, they say, you know, my quarterly revenue is up. That's what they talk about. We need to start telling a story on these networks that shows the revenue model. And that's what's going on.
Will we be able to see revenue from Twitter? And here's what I'm saying. So Twitter rolled out today to basically a dozen different brands, if you will, this option of being able to purchase. And you've got recording artists. I think Brad Paisley's one of them. Burberry is one. Home Depot, where with a select group of people, they're going to be able to, subscribers of Twitter, are going to be able to actually purchase using Twitter. And we've seen this before, but you know, I'm still not completely comfortable that, A, is it a secure way to purchase? And B, is that really how we use Twitter? I think you have to look at the platform itself and understand how we use it. I don't really follow brands on Twitter. I look for news and information. On Facebook, I might look at brands, but it's a little different user experience. And how I use Google Plus is different than how I use Pinterest. I think Pinterest makes complete sense. It's absolutely, there should be payment options on. I'd be in big trouble because I love Pinterest and I'd be buying all the time. But I don't think it really makes sense for Twitter. What do you say about that, Esteban?
I actually think it really makes sense because the audience for this is advertisers. And, you know, television was not created for people to see ads. Radio was not created for ads. Magazines were not created for ads. But that's how these media were subsidized, right? This is how they made money. And it's the same case for Facebook and Twitter. And over the past, half a decade or more, social commerce, this idea has sort of evolved from being a link and trying to get the attribution for it, the way that companies like Dell try to say, hey, we sold this amount of money over Twitter, to something like a Facebook app or a fake Facebook tab where you just had a list of products and you sold them. This idea of social commerce has always been interesting, and some brands have actually gone far enough to build platforms and tools where people could talk to each other and turn a button on and do Facebook. But in the end, what brands really want to do is connect a tweet or a presence on a social network or a social media site, and then connect that to a sale. And this is what that does. So Hunter, for example, is doing a lot for Fashion Week. And for Fashion Week, they're going to be showing boots in LA for that target market based on that weather. And they're going to do something different in London. Well, if they could actually use this product tomorrow, and I don't know if they are, but let's just assume that they did, they could actually sell those products from the tweet itself. And Evian is another example. Evian was giving away free water over Twitter. If you tweeted at them using a hashtag, they'd come to you. It was a very inefficient process, but it was very well received by people in New York City that simply wanted to get some water. They could have easily said, buy now for $0, and then you deliver it the way Uber delivers, brings a taxi to you and takes you somewhere else. So to me, it's about adding that extra layer of seamlessness where if you actually want to buy something right then and there, and let's assume that Twitter and Facebook become places where we actually hold our credit cards, and Facebook actually already is holding credit cards, then I don't see why not. I don't think it affects the user experience. And in fact, from the advertiser perspective, it enhances it. Will people actually do it? That's, time will tell.
The interesting thing about direct marketing is you don't need a lot of people clicking through to make money. You really don't. I mean, everybody talks about this has been the constant harp of the brand-based people, the people who do marketing for awareness. They talk about their buzz numbers like 40% awareness and all these numbers, and they say it's fantastic, and then they mock the direct marketers for getting 0.3%. But if you get 0.3%, you can make millions of dollars sometimes. And quite frankly, you know, all they need is a moderate success with this, and it's going to generate enough profits to be profitable for everybody. I mean, I think that's the biggest story here. And in terms of the safety, am I right about it? I mean, I think Twitter's doing this in conjunction with Stripe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with Stripe.
So there's hundreds of sites that use Stripe as well. So if you have a problem with Twitter, you're going to have a problem with a lot of other sites that you don't even know are running on Stripe.
Exactly.
So how are they going to market then this to consumers? Are they going to say, listen, this is how we're rolling it out? I mean, how are they going to make consumers feel comfortable and make
it will just show up? It will honestly just show up. The way that app install ads, most people, when they talk about advertising on Facebook and Twitter, they forget about app installs. But there's a whole group of advertisers that are advertising apps to be installed or for apps to be engaged with. And this has been big money for Facebook. And it's working really well for Twitter because you press a button, takes you to the app store, and all of a sudden you have an app. And so, you know, the way that this will work is that now advertisers are just going to have one extra option in the way that they can advertise there, right? So on Twitter, you can advertise your account, you can advertise a trend, you can advertise a tweet. Well, now you can also advertise, basically add another layer of that tweet that says, you know, a buy button. And now people can buy it. And how exactly it works in the back end, I'm not exactly sure. But if we look at the examples that they've shown so far, it's things like the fancy, you know, selling a Nest thermostat, and which is a product that's what, $200 or so. You know, it's not a big purchase, but it's not a small purchase either. So that seems to be the use case. But I can see this happening for T-shirts, you know, for pretty much anything that somebody may want right then and there, or that has a real time location, time sensitive element, you know, concert tickets, specials that have to do with a promotion that, you know, only during a certain event, only during South by Southwest, only during Fashion Week, Twitter may be a really good place to do that.
You know, it's interesting. I don't want to, I'm not a big anti-social commerce guy. I think social commerce sounds like a great term. It's a great term to describe it. But it's actually, when you think about it and you unpack about it, it's more about relevance commerce. I mean, that's where this is really going to take off, because, you know, you've got people with mobile devices interacting on social networks, seeing something that they want to buy, they press a button, they buy it, because everything works seamlessly exactly to the instant that I want it. I see it, I know it, I have it. It's relevant to what's going on with me right now. Those are the things that are going to make social commerce take off.
Well, and I want to talk about the right place to be in the social commerce and users. And I know, Bob, you've talked about this. Before we do that, though, I want to thank another one of our sponsors, because
It's time for an ad.
Yay. Jesse.
Can I help?
Well, this is a really important one, because I think, well, they're all important, but let's face it. I mean, if you're hiring, and are you hiring? Because Bob, you might be. Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? And I think a lot of people are confused about this. Well, it's not that hard, because posting your job in just one place isn't enough to get and find quality candidates. Nope. You need to post your job in a multitude of places. And if you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. That's right. With ZipRecruiter.com, you post your job to 50 plus job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with one single click. That's right. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post your job once and watch your qualified candidates roll right into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. What a hassle, right? Well, you don't have to worry about that anymore. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over, get this, 250,000 businesses. Somebody's got the idea. You should too. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/MM. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MM. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Marketing Mavericks. Great place to go. I remember when, and I actually know people that have, who like looking for a job, didn't have their application in the right place. They didn't have their LinkedIn updated. And as a recruiter, I think it's really hard to find the right people. And if you've got something that's going to make it easy for you and you can get other things done, why not try it, right? ZipRecruiter.com. I highly recommend it. And you should think about that too, Bob, because you're a busy guy. You're probably need to hire some more people, right?
That's right. Absolutely. I'm going to be using this. You know, actually, I'm a big fan of ZipRecruiter. I think that it's a great solution, both from the consumer side and from the business side. I mean, they've put together a fantastic tool that makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, I would recommend it.
Highly recommend. So, yeah, 50-plus job sites. That's a lot of job sites. So, okay, here's my question back to the whole Twitter commerce conversation. I think it makes, again, Pinterest makes absolute sense. You're on Pinterest because you're looking at things that you like and you may or may not want to buy them and you're putting them on your pin board. With Facebook, you know, you're kind of interested in things that might be available to buy. But on is the Twitter user really on Twitter because they're following brands and they may or may not want to buy something? I think
you're thinking about it in the lowest common denominator of ad units. I mean, essentially we're inserting an ad into a place, into a news stream. It's not relevant to the content and it just comes out of nowhere and it, you know, it interrupts the stream and it gives you an opportunity to buy a product, and probably not. I mean, they're probably not going to do it like that. Now, to say that just because you don't follow a lot of brands is not really the case with a lot of other people. I mean, think about it. Every gamer follows Xbox, follows PlayStation, follows the Wii. They follow all these gaming sites, etc. And if you add ads into the mix for instant purchases of like, okay, the latest game is out, purchase it now, those kind of opportunities are going to be fantastic for the brands to take advantage of. And then, of course, there's the relevancy aspect. I mean, that's where the rubber meets the road in all social commerce. I mean, you know, if Twitter, because of algorithm gate recently, you know, they're basically starting to test the opportunities to place favorited content from one user into another user's stream. Caused a lot of outrage, but essentially what the end game of that has to be, and I'm just speaking out my butt right now, I'm just, you know, speculating. But
that's
the
end, a nice visual. Thanks for that, Bob.
My butt. Okay. No, but you know, the end game has to be the fact that they're trying to figure out ways to insert content relevantly into someone else's stream that can eventually be a way to insert ads in a relevant fashion.
Well, and don't forget that, you know, if you want relevancy, ultimately every Twitter user, every Facebook user is making decisions. They have another tab and they're shopping for something in that tab. Whether they're making purchases or not, you know, we don't know. But most people on Earth with an internet connection are shopping at some point. And what does that mean? Retargeting and remarketing on Twitter, on Facebook will be relevant. Because if you're spending some time searching for a car and all of a sudden you see a tweet that says, you know, $1,500 off of that Toyota, then, you know, maybe people won't buy right then and there, but I'm sure that Twitter and Facebook are going to come up with ways to get as close as possible to getting people to go to that dealership. In the case of a Nest thermostat, people will just buy it right there and there.
Okay, so I've talked about Pinterest over and over again, and obviously I love the Pinterest. Now they've released a new tool. They've had a new analytics dashboard that is supposed to, I think, entice future advertisers. So what do you think about that, Bob? Have you had a chance to take a look?
You know, I have taken a brief look at it. When the story came out a couple weeks ago, I started to look into it. Here's the problem with a lot of marketers out there. And marketers are going to go and say, this is just another dashboard I have to use. When are you going to open up the API so that a company like Sprinklr can take care of this for me?
And great idea.
Sorry for the shameless plug of Esteban, but you know, here's the facts. I mean, customer, the marketing community, they aggregate on a tool. and they use that tool, and they want that tool to do everything. They don't want yet another dashboard. So this is a stopgap measure. It shows the brands, hey, we've got analytics. We can show you how the effectiveness of your ads are working. We can show you the commerce streams. We can do all those things that you need. But essentially, until they open up the APIs and allow these third-party vendors to come in and provide much more robust analytics, they're really not going to attract the brands to the advertising on the site.
Yeah, I think that this is great news for the small business. So the small business that, you know, is used to seeing analytics on Facebook, is used to seeing, now starting to see some analytics on Twitter ads, they're going to be really excited about this. Even normal users that, you know, for some reason do a little bit more than just personal use on Pinterest, this is fantastic. And the fact that Pinterest is building that analytics infrastructure is good for everyone. But ultimately, yeah, it's going to be about, for big brands, it's going to be about it being integrated onto platforms like Sprinklr, and we're working very closely with Pinterest. So you know, there'll definitely be an announcement about that.
Hmm. So what is Pinterest? Nobody's listening, Esteban. You can tell us whatever it is that nobody will hear.
Yeah, break the embargo there. Go ahead, break it. I want to hear that.
All I can say is that we work closely with all of them, and it'll be good. It'll be like everything Sprinklr does. It'll be good.
That's right. So what does Pinterest need? Where's the opportunity, potentially missed opportunity, with Pinterest right now, Esteban?
The what do you mean by the missed opportunity?
Is there one? I mean, is there something that Pinterest needs to do to, I don't know, whether it's gain more users or potentially reach out to advertisers better? I mean, what are they not doing that they should be doing?
Yeah, I think Pinterest has been smart. They've been careful. And in a way, it's kind of how Instagram has done it. Tumblr also had a little bit of that approach of being slow and steady and focusing on the experience and then adding analytics and adding advertising opportunities on top of that. I think that is the right way to do it. Pinterest is not as top of mind these days as it was once was, but its users are still very, very much engaged. I'm a bit of a crazy Pinterest user, and my brain is on Pinterest is what I like to say. So while the stereotype is that it's women pinning about fashion, there's also a bunch of geeks pinning about geeky things. And there's, you know, people pinning about, you know, horse riding and vacations and weddings and all kinds of things. So Pinterest should focus on its audience before it does too much with advertising, because the last thing it can't afford to alienate that audience that is using it as a utility.
Am I following you on Pinterest? Because if I'm not, I'm going to right now. So what do you think? I mean, you wanted to jump in there, Bob. What do you think about Pinterest? I mean, are you a big pinner? Are you pinning on Pinterest?
No, I'm not a big pinner. I have tried to use the site. It's a hot mess in a lot of ways. You know, I think that it's an interesting tool, and it's definitely got value, and I won't crap on it. I mean, it's a good site for what it does. But I think, despite the fact that Esteban uses it for his tech geek friends to post stuff about technology, the fact remains, the statistics bear out, it is mostly women posting about fashion and posting about, there's a big recipe community on there. I mean, it's just like, these are the things where Pinterest really shines. And I think Esteban's comment about building their audience is exactly right, but I would nuance it and say they need to show why this is a useful tool for someone like Esteban or for me. I mean, you know, Esteban has already discovered a little community, a little niche community going on there, but that needs to be much more robust for them to tap into the really big brand dollars, or else they're just going to be a niche product that's geared by the agencies who have pigeonholed them as being female products.
So who has the best opportunity on Pinterest? Is it the small business who's trying to reach a wider audience and using Pinterest, like maybe they're on Etsy now and they want to like expand, which I think a lot of small businesses are doing a fairly decent job of that, the ones that get it? Or is it an opportunity for the bigger brands, like, I don't know, the Burberry or the Ralph Lauren's, who want to reach people and get them to buy immediately? Who's the opportunity for?
I think it's a mix of what you both just said. Bob is completely right. There is a majority audience on Pinterest.
He likes hearing he's completely right, don't you, Bob?
I'm completely right.
He loves it.
I want you to
he
say that. I want that to be the clip that we play over and over again.
Bob is completely right. Bob is completely right. Bob is completely right.
Episode 22, Bob is completely
right. Can that be my ringtone? Can you send me that? I need that. Send it on Windows format.
I will practice it, and then it'll come out in the best possible way. But beyond the fact that Bob is right, obviously it means that the brands that have a stake in those communities, they should be there. I've seen very, very small businesses have, you know, big followings, 10,000 followers, when they're a small location with a single location in a small town. At the same time, you see companies like Etsy that are driving a lot of traffic. Whole Foods could benefit, right? There's a certain group of brands, and it doesn't matter whether you're a big brand or a small brand. If they do a good job of participating there and adding value to the community, I think there is an opportunity. It does take much more time and effort than most brands and small businesses realize. So a lot of people will start pinning and pinning and pinning, and 3 months later they realize that no one cares and nobody's following them, and they just give up. So there is a bit of a ramp up, and the fact is that probably the most benefit that brands get out of Pinterest is the content that others are pushing on there, not what their own accounts are doing. It really, absolutely, the e-commerce sites that are getting traffic are getting the most benefit.
Yeah, Esteban's exactly right. I mean, that's where the real value is, and that's the real value in any kind of social commerce setting. I mean, you know, we can say it's all about creating great content and getting people to engage with our content, but the holy grail of all marketing in social media is to have two customers talking to each other. And Pinterest does that better than any of the other sites because it's two customers talking about products that they like. That's a fantastic endorsement. And to be able to monetize those endorsements is where brands can really take off on Pinterest.
I have a whole pin board dedicated to scarves, I think. I don't know. I love the Pinterest. I can't help it. I would totally buy everything. In fact, it would be really dangerous.
I tried to start one for craft beer. The craft beer is fantastic, but I got it like two bottles and I'm like, this is way too hard. I just want to go down to the bar and drink my beer. I don't really want to pin about the beer. So
you should follow our host, Mary Jo, if you don't already. So she's phenomenal. I love pinning everything. So it's actually a weakness for me. I always think of Pinterest as this replacement for... So for all you old timers out there, the old Sears Roebuck catalog that was the wish book. Well, I think of Pinterest as kind of a wish book, you know, is the person that you, I always think of Pinterest as the person you want to be, the clothes you want to buy, the meals you want to cook, the things that you want in your life. That's actually maybe how you want to aspire to be, right?
I mean, I'm looking at your... Right now, and
you
I'm
have
thinking,
an aspirational view. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at your pin board right now, Tanya, and I'm just looking at it going, this is an incredible waste of time.
Tanya, let's show my pin board. Oh, I want to hear what Bob thinks about it.
Where is your pin? Are you following me? Am I following you on Pinterest? If I should be.
It'll always be /socialnerdia, but we don't have to do that. We don't have time.
We don't have time. There's always time for Pinterest. But before we get to, I want to talk about, there he is. Oh, look, you've got a picture of Scobalizer. Yeah, he was, you know what, talking about Facebook, and you guys should watch on the 29th of September, we're releasing a conversation between Leo and Robert about actual Facebook usage and how to better optimize using Facebook. And so he had a great conversation when you watched it live. You got to watch live. And then you got to watch it when it's posted. But before we get to anything else, in fact, I want to talk about maybe some advertising fails or some things that we've seen that really didn't work. So I'll give a little teaser there. But before we do, I want to talk.
My ad fail five.
Uh-oh. I want to talk about another sponsor of Marketing Mavericks, which is NatureBox, which we love here at Twit. We love NatureBox. In fact, it's a great, 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 great way to fill up your hunger and maybe put off the kind of things that you shouldn't eat. So let's just start here. Drop the candy bar. Yep. We do have candy bars. We do have potato chips. You don't need those. They're not good for you. Do what I do. Get natural, delicious snacks at naturebox.com. I'm going to give you the chance. Yep. to get free snacks with a sampler box featuring five of NatureBox's most popular snacks. NatureBox has hundreds, literally hundreds, of delicious snacks. I don't feel guilty about eating them because they're better for me. And we all get hungry. We all want snacks, whether it's late at night or when you're watching a movie, which is typically when I have my weak moment, right? I'm watching the movie. I want to grab something to eat. Choose NatureBox. They've got zero artificial ingredients, zero trans fat, and zero high fructose corn syrup, which I think is a big weakness for a lot of us. You'll feel good about snacking, actually, and you won't just overeat when you actually get ready to have your meal. You'll even find snacks that are low in sugar and gluten-free. So in the afternoon, when you're hungry, do what I do. Grab peanut butter Nom Noms from NatureBox, or maybe they're dark cocoa almonds. I don't know. Maybe they're big sweet potato fries, or maybe you got a sweet tooth and you want blueberry almond bites. Well, any of those are okay. They have tons and tons of choices, and they're all really, really good. Whether it's savory or sweet, there's something for you. So good and so good for you. So start your free trial and get a free sampler box at naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong, start snacking smarter. Go to naturebox.com/twit. And we thank NatureBox for their support of Marketing Mavericks. And I thank NatureBox for just existing and making it a better, healthier snack. Because let's face it, when we're snacking, sometimes we don't make good choices, right? I don't know. What are you guys? Are you guys savory? Are you sweet? If you follow my Pinterest, I've got both savory and sweet options on there. What do you guys favor? Savory or sweet?
I must confess, I had to quit Nutella because Nutella is evil. It is just making me addicted. And so I've had to quit. And now that I quit that, I'm looking at NatureBox. Maybe I'll order. I'll get a subscription there to get something a little bit healthier than Nutella.
I've got a dollar pizza place right outside the door of my apartment building. Right outside the door.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's some really, really crazy crap.
a good friend of Twit and a friend of the show, Marketing Mavericks. In fact, she's going to be on next week, is Natalie Morris. She talks about actually serving up NatureBox to her kids all the time. She's a super big fan. If she were here right now, I'm sure she'd say, get NatureBox for your kids. Great back-to-school snacks, for sure, for sure. So anyway, I'm a big fan. I'm more of a savory girl, though, than a sweet. So in fact, I like dark chocolate over regular chocolate, just as if
with
anybody
salt.
Cares.
Right.
With salt?
Like, what is salty stuff? Like salty? I like salty stuff, like pretzels and, you know, like spicy stuff, like hot sauces and, you know, that's
Stop
what
it.
I like.
Okay, salsa. Show's over. I'm hungry. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. So so we've seen maybe every day, but certainly every week, we see off and on, we see really bad advertising. We see people doing it wrong, you know, hashtag doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. And it's upsetting as marketers to see something happen that is, you know, you think, gosh, who are you hiring to run your marketing or social media? And as marketers, we tend to want to just, you know, criticize them and talk about it publicly. I know I follow Unmarketing Scott Scranton. He does a great job, right, of pulling out no holds barred on some of the things that are happening. What have you guys seen lately? I know, Bob, you've been chomping at the bit, and I think this is something you actually talk about on your show. What's the biggest advertising fail that you've seen over recent days?
Oh, my gosh. One of my favorite fails. We do a segment at the end of my show called the Ad Fail 5. It's pound ad fail number 5. And, you know, one of the worst ones I've seen in a long time, Malaysia Airlines, which just went through two major air disasters, ran a campaign in their English-speaking markets that was the ultimate bucket list. And if you know anything about the ultimate bucket list, it is essentially the one place where you want to go before you die. So, of course, they're running a promotion for people to write a 500-word essay on where they want to go on Malaysia Airlines before they die. I think this was, like, such an incredible failure on their part.
Yeah, that's actually not great. I think, I don't know if we talked about this last week or the week before. We actually weren't on last week. It was a holiday, but that was a pretty bad fail. And I think they're struggling in so many other ways. I don't know that that's actually going to hurt them that much more, but certainly it doesn't take a marketing genius to realize that's not something that you want to focus an ad around. What about you, Esteban? What have you seen lately?
Well, I'm going to add on top of that. I think it's interesting how airlines have so much trouble differentiating themselves, and then you see U.S. Airways sending, you know, photos you don't want to see. You see U.S. great. Airways sending not safe for work either. You also see like KLM sending out things where they're sort of making fun of Mexicans during the World Cup. Airlines love to do this. I don't know why. It's like they like to have many fails. And yeah, maybe the stock's not going to go down. But Spirit Airlines is another example. They did the whole Our Bear Fare Was Hacked ad, and they put it all over social. And it sort of, you know, it didn't get received very well. But the Ad Ages and the Ad Weeks of the world love to cover this stuff. So it's kind of interesting how, in a weird way, we end up talking about these airlines that are very undifferentiated, and all of a sudden they're stars because of their mistakes, and we forget the next day. You know, if it wasn't for Pinterest, I'd probably forget all of these, because I'm looking at them right now because there's an airline fail all the time.
You know, it's funny. Augie Ray, who comes on both of our shows, Tanya, you know, he always says, I don't understand why brands are even doing real-time marketing anymore like this, where they're these newsjacking type opportunities. It just doesn't make any sense, because you very rarely hit a home run with an amazing newsjack. And then most of the time, you're just running this incredible risk of totally screwing up and getting your name smeared all over the headlines in a very negative fashion. So, I mean, it's kind of like, I can understand wanting to be relevant on social media, but essentially this drive to come up with content that hijacks the latest news and be first with the witty comment, it really doesn't pay that much in dividends. Only a very few people become get the Arby's moment with the Farrell hat, or get the Oreo tweet with a dunk in the dark. I mean, very few brands will ever get these fantastic opportunities. All they're doing is exposing themselves to risk. They need smarter marketing strategies that are much more relevant to the consumer's needs and less about being cute with each other.
And I think what happens invariably is that some, you know, really ambitious social media person or marketer tries too hard to be cute, and they end up saying something that isn't received very well. And they, you know, you talk about newsjacking, whether it's on social issue or whatever's happening, and it tends to come across more than not really poorly. I think you're right. You know, a funny tweet or something really catchy is something that isn't a marketing strategy. It is, it just happens. I don't think that you can really plan for those things. I think you can hope to have somebody really witty that really gets social awareness to not do something really bad, but
in the ad industry, we've always called it borrowed interest. I mean, whenever we were creating an ad campaign for a brand campaign or a direct marketing campaign, if you used like this hot half-naked woman smoking a cigarette or something like that, it was considered borrowed interest. It's not really marketing the product. It's basically just attracting people through sex. And that's the lowest form of creative. It works. I mean, sometimes it works, but it's not the great marketing campaign that's going to help people understand your product and help you to get additional market share. It's just going to grab some attention and then fade really quickly.
And there's really two ways in which it works. One is luck. So, you know, the Arby's moment was pure luck. The other is having the right infrastructure and the right strategy to actually do it right. So people talk about the Oreo moment, but what they usually forget is the fact that Oreo had been doing really interesting things for about 2 or 3 years, and they had been used to doing this idea of real-time marketing, not because it was a trend, but because it was something that was resonating with their audience. And so I do think that there is a space for real-time marketing. I do think that there are brands that should be doing this. I think the Taco Bells of the world, it makes much more sense than the American Expresses of the world. But that being said, there is a problem when everybody jumps on a bandwagon just because they're supposed to, and then it can backfire when you do it poorly.
I think, and I also think it is just being aware and being on, not just from 9 to 5, but having your marketing team, your social media team, really engaged in on social media and engaged with consumers, that when those opportunities come around, you're actually online and active and you can be responsive. And I think those those brands, you're right, it's lucky. But they've also done a lot of other things. Like you mentioned Oreo. They've had some really fantastic campaigns long before the stadium outage, right? Long before the famous tweet. I think
right. In fact, and all of those campaigns that they were doing before then were not newsjacking. They were just really well thought out mm-hmm. content campaigns that keyed into core demographics within their audience. It was smart marketing. It wasn't just newsjacking, and none of that got recognized. But that was so much more valuable to them than a tweet about the fact that the lights went out in the Superdome.
I couldn't agree more. So, okay. So what are you guys watching? Besides the big announcement with Apple tomorrow, which we're all paying attention to, what's on your marketing radar, Esteban?
On mine, it's definitely the anonymous apps. I think I'm really curious to see whether these are going to sort of fade away. We've seen battles between the Foursquare versus Gowalla and Instagram and Vine and Snapchat versus whoever could try to challenge Snapchat. But the anonymous apps are these weird, dark plays where some brands don't want to go near it. And then there's a whole other group of advertisers that are very excited about it. Media and entertainment companies are interested in it. Vegas.com has done a few things. So it could be an interesting play for a niche group of marketers. And I'm just really curious as to what's going to happen as these apps become more and more popular, especially in emerging markets where freedom of speech is not as encouraged and as free as we are used to in North America.
And what are you watching, Bob? What's on your radar?
Well, I'm going to be completely self-serving because, because of Mexi is one of my clients, I'm very, very fascinated with mobile signal tracking. But it's especially interesting that right now we are on the cusp of a revolution in terms of what's going to go on in retail spaces. Retail spaces have been a dark hole, this black hole of the unknown in terms of tracking and understanding how marketing works, how customers move through the store. I mean, there's been piecemeal solutions that have been put together in place. Now, suddenly, you've got some real players coming out of the woodwork who are going to be delivering the kind of tracking that you can get on a website within a retail environment. You can heat map things. You can find out whether the end cap is driving to the product and whether the product is moving from the shelf to the POS and whether it was purchased and whether or not pushing marketing via iBeacon or aBeacon off to a device, whether or not that drives additional traffic. The way that this technology is helping in every kind of retail environment or public space, I mean, museums benefit from it, airports, security lines are using it in order to manage the security, the traffic flow through the security stations. This is going to revolutionize things, and it's all built on the back of the fact that everybody's carrying a cell phone that's emitting signals. Being able to take these non-identifiable signals, maintain the privacy of the users, and still track effectively, it's going to revolutionize everything that's going on in retail over the next 2 years.
Tracking and privacy in the same sentence, really? I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because these signals are not identifiable to an individual user. They're constantly emitting, but they can't be tracked back to an individual user until the user opts in. This has even got Chuck Schumer's endorsement. And Chuck Schumer is one of the worst privacy hawks in the business. I mean, in government in the U.S. I know Mexi, and along with a few of the other vendors, got together and put together a standards of best practices that could satisfy the privacy issues that were surrounding it and got his stamp of endorsement. So this is some really interesting technology that's going to just change the way that retailers interact with data in their own stores.
I can't wait to see it. And I'm excited. And I could do a whole show around Pinterest. We could talk a little bit more about that too, but that's what I'm watching. I'm just kidding. I'm just excited to see what happens tomorrow. I'm interested to see. And we're going to have a very interesting special here at TWiT. Everybody's going to hopefully be watching that about what's happening with the announcement. Thanks again, guys. I really appreciate your time here on Mavericks today. And following you on Pinterest and Twitter and everywhere else. If somebody wants to connect with you, what's the best way they can do that, Esteban?
Twitter.com/socialnerdia as it appears on the screen, and pretty much anywhere socialnerdia. So socialnerdia.com, socialnerdia@gmail.com, Skype, socialnerdia. If you want to reach me, just remember those two words and then I'm there.
Social Nerdia. And you, Bob, somebody wants to connect with you, find out maybe more about your Beancast. What's the best way they can do that?
Go to the website. The website is where you can find everything about me, thebeancast.com. That's the home of the Beancast. It goes on every Monday. It is the ultimate conversation in marketing. It's meet the press for the ad industry. I'd love for people to check it out. Go to thebeancast.com, and you can find out more about advertising and, of course, all the different opportunities for consulting that are available through the consulting arm of my operation. So anyway, check it all out, thebeancast.com.
All right, there you have it. Thanks, guys, and I hope you have a great rest of your week, and I'll be following you on Pinterest. And that wraps up another episode of Marketing Mavericks. You can follow Marketing Mavericks by going to Google Plus, of course. You can also follow us on Twitter. You can follow me at Tanya Hall Radio. I know. Drop the radio. I get it. I'm trying. And you can use the hashtag Marketing Mavericks. You can find me on Facebook. I want to hear from you. And you can even old school email me by emailing mavericks@twit.tv. I want to hear what you want to kind of guests you want, what topics you like, and what's your favorite part about the show. Thanks, everybody. And until next week, have a good one. We're out of here.